arrangements. Adoption, surrogacy, and paternity tests. What about the situations where it's either not a natural child or where there's a dispute as to whether a child actually belongs to one of the parents whom we're trying to be mechayev to support the children? So we'll start off speaking about just the most typical situation where there are parents who adopt a child. Now, there could be a situation where there's a step-parent, where the mother has a daughter and then she marries a second husband. So the first husband died, and he undertakes that he's going to support her. This is discussed in a Mishnah, in Ksuba Stav Kuf Aleph Amid Beis, and it's codified in the Shulchan Aruch in Siman Kuf Yudalet, in Eben Ezer, that such an obligation is considered to be binding. Not only that, but if it's an obligation that relates to, say, the daughter of this woman, it doesn't have to stop at any particular point in time. It's one thing if he agrees he's going to do it for Chamesh Shanim, so then it only continues 5 years, but it could be open-ended as well, and it could even extend to the point in time in which the husband and wife are no longer living with each other anymore, and that's discussed in Shulchan Aruch Kuf Yudalet Sif Vav, that Niskarsha B'Sochas Man Shekibo Lazu Nesabas, if they get divorced in the interim, No Sein Lav Amakom Shetiye Ima Mizonos Mushlam Kimoshe Zanis Ishto Alish, that he continues to he has to take care of the daughter in the same measure. There's a machlokis in the Mechaber and the Mama as to whether he only is obligated to take care of her in a kind of a minimal fashion. Mechaber paskins veino chayv litin la lefi kvoda v'lo lefi kvoda. The Mama says v'yesh chokim b'sovim nitzarech la'aseis la ke'echan mibnei beiso k'vechei nir ali. That if he undertook that this daughter of his the stepdaughter of his wife is going to be incorporated into his family as kind of like a full fledged member of the family, so then he has to feed her fully and take care of her as if she's a member of the family. And the assumption is, at least for Ashkenazim, that we would assume, like the Rama, that this is kind of like a standalone obligation. It would seem that even if you hold like the Ran, that normally speaking, the obligation to sustain children is an outgrowth of the chiyuv mizonos towards the wife, when one has taken upon a separate chiyuv towards a specific child, like a stepchild, so that would extend even according to the Shita Saran. It would seem to be sort of an independent, standalone obligation that's not dependent upon one's obligations towards the wife under these circumstances. Adoption really is an expansion of this type of commitment. The difference is that it's not one parent. Adoption by one parent could be that there's one parent who's the step-parent who's adopting the child of the other parent, but a variation, the more conventionally understood definition of adoption is that both parents are adopting a child, and the framework through which they would express their obligations towards the child would be similar to this notion that they're both undertaking this joint obligation that they're going to sustain the child in the same way that it's binding for the husband to obligate himself to sustain the child of the woman that he marries, the daughter of the woman that he marries. So too, two adults who marry each other can undertake the same type of obligation. This wasn't really codified in any kind of way throughout the ages in the classical halakhic literature, but Ben Tzion Uziel wrote a sefer called Sharei Uziel, and Shar Lamed Ches of his sefer Sharei Uziel, he specifically addresses this idea of what are the obligations, or what's the halakhic framework of adoption. And he says that at least the mizonos of whatever other shilos of adoption you deal with, in terms of do you fill through a vu, how does a child get called up to the Torah, where we're very familiar with is the kibud avim with some of the other adoption shilos. This one is, I suppose, less glamorous, so it's not spoken about quite as much, but it's an extremely important issue. So he writes at length about it. He says that it's really premised upon this sugya and ksuvus and upon Siman Kuf Yudal of the Shulchan Aruch, how these obligations would come into being. In fact, he's even critical of the fact that the nomenclature that became adopted for adoption became imutz yuladim. He says imutz yuladim is based on a pasuk in Tehillim. It talks about Ben Adam imatz dolach, that is a reference to kind of taking a person by force. The same way the psukim draw a contrast or a comparison to the way that you would grab a branch from a tree by force. You're taking it by force. He says, we're not taking children by force. The idea of adoption is that we're taking care of a child. The more appropriate paradigm for adoption is what the pasuk that we have in Megillas Esther with respect to Mordechai, by he omein is hadassah. That you're helping to bring up and to take care of and to preserve another individual. So really, it shouldn't be called imus yuladim; it should be called imun yuladim. But he said, since he has kicked in, he's not going to change the official nomenclature that people utilize. However, it's a better way of understanding the obligations of adoption, that it's not that you're forcibly taking somebody, but rather by heel main, you're sustaining somebody. Now, if the person's not a child, there isn't an automatic reciprocal obligation for a child. So a parent is entitled, the father is entitled to the ma'isa yodav of his children. However, this is not true with respect to, say, a situation where you simply take upon yourself certain obligations. It's not reciprocal. We don't have a built-in halacha, built-in zeiros hakasuv, that you get whatever shevach is brought in by your child. You give mizonos and you get something in return. It doesn't work that way. That's that's sif beis and simin kuf yudalid. Afal pi shehuzona ma'isa yadeha shelo. That even though there's no binu ver veisavia, that even though you're taking care of this girl that is in the case of the Shulchan Aruch, your stepdaughter from your wife, nonetheless she gets to keep her own ma'ase yadayim. So Rav Uziel already in his sefer says that even though this is the strict halacha, nonetheless, since the idea of adoption is that you are in fact incorporating this person, like we assume, like the Ramah, that you're incorporating the person completely into your, like ke'echad mi b'nei beso. So he says that we have to kind of look at in terms of the model of like Nasan Hanavi was giving a mashal to David HaMelech with respect to the sheep, right? So the poor person who only has one little sheep. And he says, "Mipito tochal, mikoso tishte," that the sheep eats and drinks and sleeps together with this person. Vatihi lo kivas, and it's like this sheep that you took in, you treat like a daughter. So he says that's really the model of adoption. It's like the poor person's sheep. That vatihi lo kivas, that it's like your regular child. So since it's your regular child, so therefore he says that he thinks that it's appropriate. That we should make a takana, that the ma'ase yadayim of the adopted children should belong to the parents. It's not necessarily automatic. Certainly, it wouldn't be the strict halacha, but in an adoption context, in order to fully integrate them into the family, they should be like full-fledged children. And he says that there's the obligation really. Of giving the mizonos is only as long as they remain members of the family, not if they decide to bolt on their own. But if they bolt because of the fact that you're treating them badly, so then you should still, the obligation would still stand. But otherwise, the understanding is that they're part of the normal family situation, the same way that you would have an obligation to marry off your regular daughters, your biological daughters. You would have the same obligation that you take upon yourself to marry off your adoptive daughters, and in all respects, we would treat it exactly the same. And Rav Melech Schechter, interestingly, wrote an article for the Journal of Halacha many years ago on the subject of adoption. And he also has a couple of paragraphs about the support obligation, where he also quotes from the Shari Uziel that the obligation would be premised, you know, on this idea of taking care of a bas ishto. Here the couple is adopting together. And as far as the idea of maisa yadea, that you'd be entitled to the maisa yadayim of the children while they're growing up, so he says that's based on hefker bezdin hefker. Somehow we've come up with a new hefker bezdin hefker rule that this would be applicable to this modern day paradigm of adoption. There's a question that arises in the context. Yes.
The only chayza that you have here
is the so-called adoption paper. Presumably, the application
is
al-daita
d'hochi. I don't know in Meretz Yisrael, in the secular law,
that
the Maisi Yadayim of the Kotten go to the father.
I don't know what the secular law is.
Yeah. That's all it is. Yeah. No Bezdin ever wrote a Shtar Imitz. So it's all implied because you signed the adoption papers. So they have to call this chayza, otherwise, in Bezdin, you have to stand up.
So he says, Rav Uziel, that it should be, you should explicitly sign a hechayvus. It's just like in a psika, you know, here. You should have a psika with respect to adoption for a person to be mechayv himself in
why
this particular fashion.
Why should anyone want to sign a hechayvus? Who's the tevaya?
Well, the children would ultimately be the tovim. But I think that the idea is, in part, that they're both committing themselves to each other in a way. You know, that if say I have the situation of a man who marries a woman who has a child, so he's obligating himself to her. Here, they're obligating themselves to each other. The big question would be, what if both of them want to step away from the obligation? Who's going to obligate the two of them if they decide in the middle that they're not going to do it anymore? So we have that. We have that type of arrangement. That's what we call a foster child arrangement, which is different from an adoptive child arrangement, where a person takes upon themselves for like a short term. That's like chayev, you know, paska lazun chamesh shanim or shalosh shanim or shana echas. You have that all the time with respect to foster children. Unless you formalize the arrangement.
Court proceedings, you have to say that that's a
yisrael. And then it becomes a yisrael v'sal p'dina d'machusadina. You could, if you're doing it through the court proceedings, you know. So that's kind of like at least the paradigm for adoption. It would seem if you have such an arrangement, there's another question that comes to mind. I haven't seen anybody address this this question. And this question probably, as I'll point out, arises in a variety of other contexts as well. Sometimes the biological parents are not in the picture anymore. Maybe they died in a car crash, I don't know. But sometimes the biological parents are in the picture. Now, if they're not Jewish, so it's fine. Maybe you do a ger katan mapilon also al das bezdin ger shenis gayer katan shenola dami. They don't have any halachic connection to their, you know, biological parents. Sometimes you have arrangements with their adoptions, and because it was a Jewish mother, she's not able to take care of the child. Just had such a situation in Chicago. There was a Jewish woman. She became pregnant. She was a single girl. And didn't want to have an abortion, but, you know, didn't want to keep the child either. So they gave up the child for adoption, to find another nice Jewish family to raise the child. So what happens if a few years down the road, the biological parent says, "We changed our mind, we want the child back." So how do you figure out kind of like a child custody, you know, issue, haksakas yiladim, when it comes to this type of thing? We discussed last time the Shuva the Ma'arit said that if you have a woman who, for example, gives up her rights to her daughter and says it's okay. I don't want to take care. I don't want to raise her. And then she changes her mind, so she has the right. We say that mechila is not forever because you can't be mocha the child's rights, and a daughter has the right to be raised by her mother. So let's say the biological mother comes back into the picture and says that my daughter has the right to be raised by her mother, and I'll provide a fine atmosphere for her, and I am, after all, the biological parent. So pipashtus, you could have some serious issues in that regard. If you adopted through a dinan de machusa arrangement of the state and you're dealing with non-Jews, so they were bound by the dinan de machusa. But these are dinan nefashos. If there was a Jewish child, let's say it was done through the dinan de machusa, it doesn't really matter. When it comes to something like dinan nefashos, it shouldn't be binding if the case was brought to Beis Din. So then there would still be the possibility that the person would be able to assert certain rights. Again, it's not their rights, it's the rights of the child. Maybe there's a benefit to being able to be raised by a biological parent. Again, you have the Chuvas HaRashba HaMiuchesis L'Ramban Simin Lamed Ches, who says that the Beis Din is apotropos shel Yesobim, and ultimately they have to make the determination as to what's in the best interests, of the child. And it could be it's already in the best interest if they started to be raised by another parent, but it's not necessarily a davar pashut. If it turns out that there's a feeling that there might be a certain benefit to the biological closeness of the biological parent. So I'm going to point out that this doesn't come up too often, but it could come up in other contexts where you have kind of these blended families or adoptive arrangements, and we're going to revisit this question when we discuss surrogacy arrangements. So I'd like to move on to that for a moment. Now, let's say that I have parents, and they're married to each other, and they're going to bring a child into the world, but they're just not able to conceive normally, and they have to conceive through some sort of in vitro fertilization, or through some kind of what used to be called artificial insemination type of arrangement. So here, whether or not a man who has a child through this type of arrangement has a chiyuv mizonos al pidin really is a question. And the sport and the yotzer poskim different opinions. It may depend in part upon whether you paskin that there's yichus between the child and the father. According to the Beis Shmuel, there's yichus that the father fulfills pru avu. The Taz says maybe there's only yichus l'chumah, but there isn't yichus l'kula, so he doesn't fulfill pru avu, but I have to be worried about that they shouldn't marry any other siblings who are children of the father. So if it's l'chumah, so maybe we would say that that's only a chumah l'gabi yisurim, but it's still a suffix. So if it's a suffix, so maybe emotzi and mamon, api rov or api suffix, and therefore the father wouldn't necessarily have an obligation. There are others who say that even the Taz would agree that there's a yachas when it comes to artificial insemination, because the Taz specifically said nisabra bambati. There isn't yachas because pru avu is a mitzvah kumbe esse, and the nisabra bambati, the father's not doing anything here. At least there's some sort of an act of where he causes willfully his zera to come out in order to be placed into his wife's womb. So maybe even according to the Taz, there would be yachas. It comes up also in the context of Yibum. The Sefer Halitz Chalitza Kehochasa says that even though there's a machlokis when it comes to other inyonim, when it comes to whether this child who is born through artificial insemination would exempt the parents, say the mother, from having to do Yibum or Chalitza with the husband's brother in the event that the husband dies and their only child or children were born through artificial insemination. So uvein ein lo ayein ala b'chol makom implies that we have a more lenient standard. It's b'chol makom, however tenuous the relationship might be, a little bit of yichus good enough in order to exempt when it comes to yibum. That's sort of a novel shita. I could have said that because this is a davar shebe iser, maybe a davar shebe erva at some level, I'd be much more machmir that not to pata when it comes to yibum or chalitza, but that's his assumption. So Moshe Feinstein in Eben Ezra Chelek Aleph Siman Yud asks the following question: say that it's not a situation where it comes from the father. The zera is coming from another person. This was a big dispute as to whether that would create mamzeris or not, whether that's mutter. If Moshe held, strictly speaking, it was mutter, he became less excited about it over time. It gave him a very hard time about this tshuva. Others claim that Tzitz Eliezer was a ish lahava against it, and the for all kinds of different practical reasons, you won't know who your siblings are. You'll come to you won't know whether the mother is ptur michalitza, not ptur michalitza, etc., etc. And the Minchas Yitzchak held that it would be adultery mamish. Even the giving of zera creates an iserashis ish, even if it's not through intercourse, according to the Minchas Yitzchak. And others before him had said the same thing. I think. I'm sorry. I think the Minchas Yitzchak says that as well. Okay. All right, that's my recollection. And so there was this concern from all quarters about whether or not you could do this, but Moshe held. I'll call upon him that if you did it, the child's not going to be a mamzer. And because he says a mamzeris is only created to be a mamish, this isn't to be a mamish, it's not going to create mamzeris. Nobody has to get divorced, they can stay together, and the child legitimate. But is the father obligated to sustain the child who's born this way through mizonos? He's not the real father. Nobody would claim that there's a yachas between the father who didn't provide the zera. At one point in time, they would do it creatively. They would say, even if the father didn't have zera that was capable of procreation, they take like a little bit of the father's zera and mix it together with the zera of the person who is really going to effectuate the pregnancy, so that they could, you know, maybe have a doubt in their mind that maybe the father had something to do with it. But later on, apparently, this practice was discontinued because it was felt that it could potentially have unhealthy side effects. So that's not even done anymore. So it's not even a suffix. It's known that the father was definitely, the husband is definitely not the father of this child. So Rav Moshe says that... I have no idea. I'm sorry?
Psychological.
Yeah, it could be. I don't know if it's medical unhealthy side effects. Right, because you'd have to wonder if there are medical unhealthy side effects. So if it could, you know, do bad, maybe it could do good too. Right, yes, I know. Rav Moshe says that it's dependent, the father's obligation is dependent on, pardon, or the husband's obligation is dependent upon whether he agreed to the procedure or not. If the husband agreed to it, so then he's obligated to it. But otherwise, he was never mischayev himself to take care of this child. The wife did it on her own. She wanted to have, she didn't want to be childless, so she went out. Hard to understand the Shalom Bayis here. She went out on her own, and she decided to become impregnated by through somebody else's zera, through artificial insemination. Shiloh, whether if he discovers she's pregnant one day, is she believed to say that's how she became pregnant? The answer is no. It's such a milsad lo shchiyah. She would have to, you know, really he would have to really know that he did it, that she did it through artificial insemination. But he's assuming this is a case where it was known that the way she became pregnant was through artificial insemination. He saw her go to the hospital, whatever. We'll get to that. We'll get to everything in due course. So Rav Moshe says that if he didn't agree to it, so then he has no obligation whatsoever. If he did if he did agree to it, what's the nature of the obligation? So some Rav Moshe doesn't spell that in that tshuva. Some say the obligation is the nature of arif. It's like a chi of arif that he's saying. Okay, it's not really my obligation per se. But I'm going to take it out, arvus. Now again, you don't have to say that. You could say it's similar to the halakha in Kesim and Kuf Yudalit, that he just undertakes paske imo, lazun es bita. So this is a case where it's definitely bita or bina, and he's taking it upon himself. Neither what?
A
kinyan, yeah, but to that you would need some sort of a kinyan. Even for arvus, you would need some sort of a kinyan, per se. So either way, whatever's the nature of the obligation, you could need some sort of a kinyan. You could say that maybe for the practice of beginning to support would be like an implicit kinyan. Now, what if it was nolad, the child nowadays, what has become increasingly more common is that, let's say, the zera of the husband... it's not the issue. The issue is that the wife is not able to carry the child to pregnancy, or there's an issue with her eggs, And they have to, you do a surrogate arrangement where the egg of the wife is going to be taken, and it's going to be taken out. It's going to be impregnated through the zera of the husband, so that's not the the issue. Again, you have the same, you know, questions here as to, you know, whether that type of, whether having his zera go into her through some sort of a test tube mechanism, since the egg is first, you know, fertilized outside of the body, whether that creates a yachas. There's some who say that even if you hold that artificial insemination creates a yachas, maybe this would not create a yachas because it's already through a machine. And supposedly the Stipler is quoted as holding that way. But let's say that they go through this, and now the wife doesn't carry the baby, but they use somebody else to carry the baby. So there's a whole diun as to who the mother is. This is an old question as to if is the mother the genetic mother? Is the mother considered to be the gestational mother? Rabbi Bleich, I think, wrote at one point in time, maybe, you know, the answer to "Are you my mother?" is, "Yeah, you are my mother." That the both of them are considered to be the mothers on some level. Everybody brings different rayos for their position. Zalman Nechemya Goldberg brings the case of the Yevamos, right, about the Shnei Yachim Ta'omim, who are converted in their mother's womb, that they are considered to be they're considered to be related to each other for purposes of incestuous relationships. So since they're considered to be related to each other, that would seem to indicate that since Gershini's Gayer Katan Shinola Dami, that the relationship is determined at the moment of birth because they were both converted within the womb. Others bring kashas on this particular raya. So there are rayas in all different directions. Some of them are api medrash, but however you understand it, it has an impact with respect to even establishing the paternity of the father. Because let's say that the woman who carries the baby is a non-Jewish carrier. So if I say that maternity is established only by the genetic mother, and the carrier is a non-Jewish woman, so then the child is going to require a... then the child will not require a geirus because the mother was the genetic mother. The carrier is just kind of bringing it to the finish line, but I could still say that the father has a yachas with the child, the mother has the wife has a yachas with the child, and this woman who was the surrogate mother, even though she was not Jewish, she doesn't affect the Jewishness of the child, and therefore there would be potentially a direct chi of mizonos. But if I say that the child requires a geir, because the surrogate mother, who's the gestational carrier, is really considered to be the true mother of the child, so then you wouldn't have a direct chiyuv mizonos unless there was an explicit assumption, kinyan, of obligation that was taken on by the father under these circumstances. But this also raises the question again with respect to haksakas yeladim. How does it relate to the question of haksakas yeladim? So there was a famous case in 1988 called Baby M. What was the Baby M case? That there was a couple, I assume a Jewish couple actually, the Stearns, who hired a woman whose name was Mary Beth Whitehead to carry their child to term. I think it was a girl at the end who was born, and the arrangement was that Mary Beth Whitehead would, I guess, be paid maybe for her trouble, whatever was legal for them to pay her, and carry the child to term, and then give the child back to the parents. So Mary Beth Whitehead did this, but then she changed her mind, and she said, I want the child. I want the child for myself. And it went to the Supreme Court of New Jersey, and in the end they said that it was in the best interest of the child to stay with the Stearns. They were loving, competent parents, but since she was the birth mother, this Mary Beth Whitehead, she's therefore also had certain custodial rights, and they gave her a certain amount of visitation rights. The child, later on, when she became an adult, she said, I don't want to have anything to do with my gestational mother. I like my other parents better. And I'd like, and the gestational mother became excluded from her life, but at least until that point in time, she was given certain visitation rights. So different states have enacted laws. Some don't even allow the arrangements altogether. Some states that allow it altogether, I think in Canada, if I'm not mistaken, we have a Canadian lawyer here, that these arrangements are considered to be permissible, and you can stipulate that the gestational mother is going to give up all of her rights, all of her future rights to the child, and the child will remain in the custody of the parents. So again, there's a whole debate as to when you're doing this type of arrangement, whether it's better to have, let's say that the egg mother is going to be the wife of the couple, and they need to have a gestational mother carry the child to terms. There's a whole halakhic debate as to whether it's better to have a Jewish gestational carrier, or whether it's better to have a non-Jewish gestational carrier. And the advantages of a Jewish one, obviously, are that the child has he's born with a Jewish neshama. You don't have to worry about a gerus. There's more of a yichus connection, certainly with respect to the father. However, you understand who the true mother is. At least the husband is got to have a connection with the child either way. Assuming that, you know, some sort of a yachas when you have these reproductive technology arrangements. However, if you would use a non-Jewish surrogate carrier, so then it also has advantages. You don't have to worry about arayus issues, that the brother will, you know, marry a half-sister, the daughter will marry a half-brother by accident. You don't have to worry about those types of issues. And the post can go back and forth on this. Yeah?
Hashkasa
Zera?
Yeah. It's just a
different name. Right, right. Yeah, they talk about whether it's mutter altogether.
The material are only for peri-peri.
Right.
Oh,
if the child would be an akum, so then right, in Achinami, yes, 100%. And one criticism of using a non-Jewish carrier is that there's no heter for somebody to be motzi zerah to bring a non-Jewish child to the world, even if they're going to be megayer the child afterwards. So that's also a consideration. It's also part of the debate.
Jewish mother,
I also don't know. Yeah. So it's not. These are not drum shooting, and others say no, not necessarily. I mean, it's all especially if you hold that the genetic mother is really the mother, so therefore it doesn't matter if I do a gil l'chumah, maybe it's l'chumah b'yalma. So these are some of the considerations.
Is there ever a case where the carrier is the sister of the father?
I mean, the carrier is related to the father.
The father and sister.
I don't know if there's been such a case where the carrier is related, but there would clearly be, you know, a potential issue. According to Rav Moshe, you can't ever create mamzerus in these types of situations, so you don't have to, you know, worry about that per se.
There was a case recently where the genetic mother's mother was the gestational carrier.
You know, in the classical case of artificial insemination, which is brought down in the postgame of the Midrashim, Rabbeinu Peretz, you know, brings down this case. It was Ben Sira. How was Ben Sira conceived? Ben Sira was Nisapra Beambati, okay? And it's assumed he was the son of Yirmiyahu. He's the son of Yirmiyahu, he had to have a mother too. So who is the mother exactly who was Nisapra Beambati? It wasn't Ben Sira, it was Nisapra Beambati. He was born from the woman who was Nisapra Beambati. So according to the Medrash, it was Yirmiyahu's daughter. Yirmiyahu's daughter was inseminated to her father's Zera, but nobody seems to suggest that there was any tint of Mamzeris with respect to Ben Sira. They say that the name Sira is the gematria of Yirmiyahu. That's how they kept track of his lineage. He was originally called Ben Zera, but that didn't sound very nice, so they changed Ben Zera to Ben Sira. But he was born in that particular fashion, and this is one of the rayos that you can't create Mamzeris in this particular way. But I don't think any of the cases that I'm familiar with, the carrier was a relative of the inseminator per se. So let's say I have a situation where it is a Jewish carrier, a Jewish mother is the gestational carrier, And they have this type of a surrogacy understanding, like with Mary Beth Whitehead, that it's going to go to the it's going to go to the parent. It's going to go to the this couple afterwards. The child will go to the couple after the child is born, and the surrogate mother gives birth to the child. So if it was codified, say, in the legal system, like in a jurisdiction where this type of an arrangement is permitted, and one would have the ability to carry a child and give away all of their parental rights, and it was a non-Jewish carrier, so then you have no problem. You have the Dina de Malchus Adina, and you don't have to worry that the non-Jewish carrier is going to ask for the child back if it's New Jersey. So they didn't have a law in the books, they established certain visitation rights. But let's say there is a law in the books, so then you wouldn't have to worry about it. But let's say that the carrying mother was a Jewish carrier. And this Jewish carrier afterwards said, I don't want to honor the agreement. I want the child back. Let's say they bring the case to Beis Din. And the couple that used the gestational carrier says, well, we live in a jurisdiction where this agreement is binding, and therefore she has no rights to the baby. So what's the halacha? So the halacha presumably is that Beis Din is not bound by the Dina de Machusa over here. This is not a strict law, a din of property law, Dina Mominus. This is, again, the Beis Din Zavian Shel Yisomim, what's in the best interest of the child, and maybe there would be a determination that it's in the best interest of the child to be with the carrier mother. Maybe not, but maybe yes. It's certainly a possibility. The strict din that is that the woman who gives birth, if we assume that she's really the mother, let's say the Beis Din would have to be done on that issue for altogether, but if Beis Din determined that she was really the mother, I'll be din, like say Rav Zalman Nechemia and the others, the Meir Arik, the many poskim who are of the opinion that it would all follow the carrier mother, so then HaMechila would, as the Ma'arit said, is not a binding Mechila Liomead. If it's a daughter, she can always assert that she wants to be able to raise the daughter according to the ways of the daughters of Israel. If it's a son, she can certainly say, at least for the first 6 years, that the son should remain under her care. She could even make an argument that maybe she's the only parent. You can argue that the father doesn't really have yachas in this situation, and therefore even for the sons, she's the best situated to raise him and take care of him. Beis Din would have to deal with that particular issue. You wouldn't be able to have a full-fledged security if you utilized a gestational carrier who was a Jewish gestational carrier, there would be a full protection from birth mother asserting her parental rights or privileges, or call it responsibilities, with respect to this child, the Omeyad. There's always the possibility that she could come back to Beis Din one day. It's interesting that if you look in the whole parsha of the Beis Zonos, of the two women who were fighting over the Loki b'nei chamesu b'nei hachai, over who was the real mother of the child who was alive, who was born. So what were these Beis Zonos? What are we talking about? So I think Rashi says it was Noshim Pundakos. These were women who were innkeepers. Pundakos nowadays is the word that we use for the surrogate mothers. It was the first fight of the surrogate mothers, saying that we gave birth to the child. We gave birth to the child, so we feel that we have certain rights with respect to the child. So I haven't really seen this particular consideration thrown into the cheshbon of what we should bear and take into mind when determining whether it's better under surrogacy arrangements to utilize a Jewish carrier or a non-Jewish carrier. But bear in mind that if you do have a Jewish carrier, then if she wanted to assert a claim in Beis Din afterwards, then Mestama, at least the claim, I don't know how far the claim would go, but at least the claim could technically be asserted. There's a whole literature now about property rights with respect to husband and wife. If you have pre-embryos that were created during the course of the marriage, or what do you call it, called cyrovase zera, of the husband, that sometimes they have the husband's not able to conceive normally, or he's about to go through procedures that will make him incapable of having children afterwards. So before he goes through those procedures, he wants to cyrobase his zera so that it could be utilized to impregnate his wife in the future. And now they separate. And the wife says, I want to use the cyrobase, the zera, to have a child. So does she have the ability to use the zera in that fashion? So there's a whole literature about this. There were court cases about this here in America, a famous Tennessee case called Davies versus Davies, where originally they were going to allow the wife to use the zera. Then the upper court came to the conclusion that the husband also has certain property rights, therefore if it couldn't be done against his will. There was a similar case in Eretz Yisrael. It was the Nachmani case. Danny and Ruth Nachmani went through the courts in Haifa, made its way up to the Israeli Supreme Court. The Israeli Supreme Court ruled as was the case where there were pre-embryos that had been manufactured, and the wife wanted to be able to use it. They were fertilized through the husband's zera, and the husband said, I don't want her to use it after we're already estranged from each other. And ultimately, the Israeli Supreme Court ruled in favor of the husband. Rav Shaul Yisraeli agreed with that determination, because he said that it's understood that when we allow all of these practices, it's meant to be in the context of a stable marriage and marital relationship, and not afterwards. I had a case here, I think it was in this very room. I heard a case a few years ago. It was a couple who was getting divorced, and the husband had cyrobased the zera through A-Time, I think was the name of the organization. It works, I think, together with Machon Pua in terms of performing these procedures. And they had tried to use it in the past, and it had never really worked. And the husband wanted to ensure when they got divorced that the wife wasn't going to try to use his cyrobase there again. So he said, I don't want to give the get until I have assurances that she's not going to use my zera. I need to have proof that she's not going to make me into a father against my will. So that was the most interesting taita that I ever heard for a fellow, you know, holding up a get. We said she had a psak from, I think, a dayan in Crown Heights that said as long as they weren't actually divorced, she still had the right to use the zera. So we told the fellow, actually, you're probably in better shape if you give the get right away, because then, you know, even that psak won't be binding anymore. So he gave the get, and then we still had a din Torah afterwards, after the giving of the get, as to what type of proof should be produced to demonstrate that the cyrobased zera was no longer viable and no longer in existence. So we had letters, I think, from these representatives of these organizations verifying that there was no more cyrobased zera of this particular husband, but these are what we call modern-day shilos that come up. And it relates to the whole question of can there be a paternity past the duration of the person. This is a question of can there be paternity beyond the marriage. The poskim will talk about can there be paternity beyond the person's life. The famous shaila that Rabbi Yisraeli dealt with, there was a few shailas like this, B'marei HaBazak. You can chelek dalet B'marei HaBazak. So he was asked a shaila that came into the Eretz Chemda Institute, as to whether a child that would be born with a husband's zera after he died could pater the woman from Yibum and Chalitza if she becomes impregnated with his zera afterwards. And he brought a raya from famous Shuva of the Noda Biyehuda. It says that it has to have court. The zera has to have court before the husband dies in order to pater a woman from Yibum. That's why we wait only 3 months to see if she's pregnant, not 3 months and 3 days. Because even though it takes 3 days to be collate the zera, because if it's only Niklat after his death, it doesn't matter anyway. But not everybody necessarily agrees with the Noda B'Yehuda on this particular point. But he brings that as a raya, and he says, based on also kind of reverse Derachei Darchei Noam, the Gemara in Yevamos says that if there were children that were alive at the time of the husband's death, and then the wife goes out and she marries somebody, Bashuk, based on there being children, and the children die afterwards. Do we revoke the permission? We say, no, she already got married. We can't revoke the permission. So he makes the same argument. When he died, there were no children, and she had the ability to perform Yibum. So now, 5 years later, there's got to be a child born, maybe not even to her, to somebody else from the father of Zerah that he's Sarove somewhere. And we're going to say that it turns out that she's over on the Yisr Veishis Ish because he has Zerah after all. That would be a violation of Derechei Adachei Noam. So not everyone agreed with this tshuva of Rabbi Yisrael, though Rabbi Shlomo Zalman held the same way. He published in the Mincha Shlomo, but Gestetner published a tshuva in the back of Chalitza Kehilchasa. He says, what do you mean? The whole idea is, v'lo yimach ha-shmo b'Yisrael. Here it says, shmo eino machoi. If he has a child, even if the child is born after death, it's shmo eino machoi. So so therefore he thinks that it would pater from Yibum and the Chalitza, even if the impregnation took place after death. Then he has another tshuva as to an almana, presumably who wasn't almenis l'chalitza, who just wanted to know. They were never zocha to have children, and her husband died, but he set aside zera for her, whether she could use the zera after his death. And they have a very nice diplomatic tshuva saying that there probably may not be any violation if he agreed to it, going against his wishes, but it's, again, not good for the child. It's not good for the child to be born under those circumstances. So Bakshi Doron had a piece in Asya that I came across, in which he held very strongly that outside of the context of marriage, a person shouldn't sirobase their zera. Let's say a man is going through a surgical procedure or medical ordeal where if he doesn't set aside his zera now, he won't be capable of having children in the future. He's very much against it. Says that not everybody necessarily agrees. He was dealing with a case where the man was engaged to be married, and he wanted to do it before the marriage. And he said, no, you got to wait. You got to wait till you get married. He said, well, at that time, it may not be viable anymore. But the Maisa, so they listened to Rabbi Bakshi Doron, and they waited, and I think he wrote like as a postscript that, and it turned out that it was viable, and they were able to use it even afterwards. So you see, I was right. Kadosh Baruch Hu helped out. So these are some of the modern day shilas that arise. There's a very ghoulish shila that nobody asked me my opinion as to whether they should publish it, but I found this in Chela K of the Mareya Bazak. They wanted to know. I guess they were having such a good time with the other shilas, they figured they'd throw in one more. So this was a shila that the husband died. He didn't leave aside any zera, but the wife still wanted to have a child through her husband. So she wanted to know, perform an autopsy or perform a procedure on the husband post-mortem after he's already dead in order to extract the zera from the dead body in order to be able to procreate in that fashion. And they actually have a tshuva on it in which they say, well, it's a problem of whether it's hanam, minames, but Herzog says that if you take a cornea out, that's not an isser hanam because you're saving another person's life. And you're bringing a child into the world. Maybe it's not so bad. What about nivola mace? Rav Moshe writes that if you just have kind of like a needle that you're putting through for a biopsy, maybe that's not so bad. On the other hand, they quote Dr. Abraham Steinberg as saying, well, that's not considered to be nivola mace, but taking out zera afterwards, yeah, that really would be nivola mace. So the whole thing is just it makes you realize we're living in a brave new world, as they say. So I was thinking as well that
their maskana?
Their maskana was one of their typical tshuva, kind of the presentations, which was, well, if not for the nivola mace issue, it looks like, maybe there's something to, to be sumich upon, but we're not going to tell you to do it. So,
how long is there a viable after death?
I really have no idea. It's kind of interesting that this would even be a possibility, right? It's really, it just creates all kinds of questions.
The issue must arise with frequency because, you have Rahman, so many people that get died, that are single, get
that. That does happen. That's the much more common situation where people do it during their lifetime.
So it must arise frequently.
Right, and there's a basis to be makel. Again, I haven't been discussing so much the Hashkasa Zera issues and under what circumstances these can be done. Most poskim are makel if it's done for purposes of Priya V'Ribya, and it's done, if it can be done in a procreative fashion, the Chatzchila, that obviously makes it better. Now, this brings to mind, you know, the possibility as well of another reason not to perform Yibum b'zman hazeh. If you assume that, like Rav Gishtetner, you know, wrote that this really, you know, would pater the woman from Yibum, even if it was born, you know, 5 years later. So, you know, you have the famous comment of the Maritz Kiyos, who was asked whether they should perform Yibum in his times, and he said, well, you know, the main reason, well, one very strong reason why we all don't allow Yibum, b'zman hazeh, besides Abba Shol, is that you never know. There's so much pretzis in the world. Maybe the late husband really had a child through some illicit relationship, and we never found out about it. So if you're going to worry about that, so nowadays we're saying maybe the husband sarabes some zera somewhere, and you know there'll be a child born, you know, at some point in time. So therefore, you have to stay away from yibum. However, I don't really think that's something that we would be concerned about in the normal course. Now, let's say that. This is all talking about kind of in the marital context, again, where I have either parents who adopt a child, or I have parents who have a child through reproductive technologies like artificial insemination, or there's or the surrogate motherhood, or cyro-based zera. But let's say that I have a different sort of situation where they're married, and the wife has a child, but there's a question as to whether the husband is really the father. The husband isn't necessarily sure that he's really the father. He says that he's not really the father. So this comes up really in the context not only of marriage, but it comes up in the context of a couple that has a child outside of marriage. If I have a boyfriend and girlfriend, and the girlfriend has a child, how do we establish an obligation upon the boyfriend that he has to take care of the children? How do we establish paternity? So the Shulchan Aruch quotes in Siman Ayin Aleph, in Sif Dalet, I think, that Habala Pnuya V'yalda Mimenu, that if a man has relations with a Pnuya, and he has a child through the Pnuya, so only if he admits that the child is from him is he obligated to take care of the child. What if he doesn't admit? So if he doesn't admit that the child is from him, so even if he had relationships with her, even if he was a boyfriend who was not careful about keeping the halacha, and they lived together, nonetheless, if he says any yodea, the Beis Shmuel says, this is similar to the case of the machlokas in the Gemara, where even though she says, where let's say I have a malveh who says that barili, that you owe me money, and the lover says I have a shema, maybe I do, maybe I don't. So we paskin like Rav Nachman that bari b'shema bari, odif lahotzi, that it cannot, it's not strong enough to be motzi. We say he's pater in such a case. So he says just like the person would be pater in that bari v'shema case, even if the girlfriend comes along and says bari li, that this child is from my boyfriend. If the boyfriend says, I don't know, I lived with you, but you probably had other boyfriends too. Or it may have come from somebody else, so I can't say for sure that it's from me, so then he's not obligated to take care of the child. Then we say that he's off the hook. That's the sheet, that's the Ribash. The Ribash Simon Mem Aleph has a tshuva on this. The Ribash's case was where he denied even having relations with her altogether, but the Ribash says that even if he would have relations with her, and he would say that I'm not sure that the child is mine, so then he doesn't have an obligation to take care of her.
Why would that be more similar to that case where a person admits that
because he doesn't know that he did at all. Wait, because he has relations with her, he owes her something. Who says every time you have relations with somebody, you owe them something? That's a separate question. Whether that's
well,
in that's,
saying he's yeah. Admitting that he had relations. Now she has a child.
So.
So how does he say that?
Yeah.
It's not
a strong. He says that's any of the He says I don't know that it's mine. So he doesn't know that he ever was obligated. He doesn't know he was ever obligated. So the Shulchan Aruch paskins like the Rivash. Not everyone was so crazy about the Rivash. Tashbetz disagreed with the Rivash. Tashbetz Chelik based him in Yutes as a tshuva in which he disagrees with the Rivash. Tashbetz is quoted by later poskim, but Shulchan Aruch doesn't quote the Tashbetz. So the Piskei Tshuva in Simen Kufayin Zayin.
He's always chayav.
Tashbetz says if there's no other man in the picture, then he would be chayev. That's what the Tashbetz assumes. It's partially based on your on an analysis of the sugya and yevamos and daf samach tes amud beis daima mine lo daima miyama. If he's also she's also daima miyama, you know. So the two lashonas arava over there.
Even if he says he never.
Tashbetz would say that if he said that he never the Tashbetz would say he has to take a shvuah. If he never had relations, he has to take a shvuah. He says if he had relations, then and she was in daima miyama, so then he's chayev. That's what the Tashbetz assumes. But he says that because he would be chayev if he was moda that he had relations. Therefore, even if he says he doesn't have relations, then we can be mechayev and shvuah. So then the whole court is all din and poskim as to whether at the very least we can be mechayev and shvuah. And that maybe if he says, it's from me, I mean, I had relations with her, but I don't know if the child is from me, so maybe we can be mechayev him to take a shvua, that I take a shvua, she'eini yodea she'hu mimeni. Take a shvua that that I don't know for sure that the child is from me. Okay, that he should take a shvua along those lines. So the Pesachei Tshuva quotes Ksam Sofer. The Ksam Sofer says that if you have like a confluence of everything in favor of the... of the wife in this case, which she's, we know that she was miuchedis lo. So the Rosh talks about a situation where the woman is miuchedis to the man. That's in Simon Klal Pei Beis of the Rosh. So we know that the woman was miuchedis lo. And we know and that she was not daima me'alma. And we have no reason to suspect that she was with other people. And he's mode, or we have edim that demonstrate that he was ba'aleha. See, if you have all of those conditions together, so then the minig is that we have him take a shavua. That's what he says. So Ezra Batsri had a case like that, that's written up in the Piskei Din Rabbanim, and he quotes this in his Sefer on Hilchos Ishus, Dina Ishus. So Ezra Batsri says that he was presented with such a case. This is published in Chelek Tes of the Piskei Din Rabbanim. So he followed kind of the Ksam Sof, only he went a step further. He said, since our practice, Bizman Hazeh, is that we don't administer shvuos in the Din Torah proceedings, so therefore I followed a pshara. He said, since he should have taken a shvuah in this case, but he couldn't take a shvuah, therefore we were mechayev in mizonos, al pi pshara, meaning that the full amount of mizonos with a one-third discount. Pshara Kvova Ladin, and in such a case they let him off one-third because of the fact that they let him off without a shvuah. That's what he said. He didn't actually say, he just quoted that you can have a one-third discount. I guess you could make the argument the other direction. Maybe they only should have been mechayev in one-third. He doesn't say exactly the amount that he was mechayev at the end, just that they took into account this equation of the one-third discount. In that you should have him pay through pshara, you should have him pay. He didn't. He quoted the shlish factor, but he didn't say exactly how much they were mechayev him to pay. So then the question becomes: but what if you could potentially prove paternity or maternity through paternity tests that you could actually use, you know, testing like we have nowadays? It comes up also, I mentioned at the beginning, and sometimes you had married couples. There are a number of cases like this where Ravi Yosef has a couple of tshuvas like this, where you had a married couple, where the husband said, I don't think that the wife was faithful to me. I have evidence she wasn't faithful to me, and I don't think that the children are mine. So there, you start off with the presumption of Robilos Hochen Acharabal, but at the same time, a father is believed midin Yakir, Yakiren Alachemim, to say Beniza Mamzer, to say that this is not my child, this child is a Mamzer, he has Nemonis when it comes to that. So Rav Uziel has some sort of a shita where he says, well, the father is Nemonis about the kashrus of the child, but he doesn't have Nemonis to be released from his onus. Then we just say Robilos Hochen Acharabal. Rav Yosef says, what are you talking about? He goes, Habaha, tell you that if he has Nemonis, he has Nemonis. We says he doesn't have such nemonis as we think he has. If he just says the child's not for mine, but it's not on the basis of any good premise, then he doesn't necessarily have nemonis. So if we know the child was born at a certain point in time, he has the case. The child was conceived sometime between December 10th and January 20th. I don't know how they figured out. They figured out a case. The child was conceived sometime between December 10th and January 20th. So if the husband was with the wife at any point between December 10th and January 20th, then he has no right to go against the chazak of Obilos Hochin Acharabal to say the child isn't his. If he didn't have relations with her, so then he has the right to make that assertion. But otherwise, he doesn't have the right to make that assertion. He has a general principle. He quotes from Rav Yoshev as well, that if we're going to reach the conclusion that the child is not a mamzer, that means that the child, meaning halakhically, we're going to come to a conclusion that the child is kosher. So then it would follow that the chi of mizonos, the takana of the chi of mizonos, is talya b'bino shem yucha sacharav. So once I figured out that the b'no is yucha sacharav, so then he has the chi of mizonos. Then he can't wheedle out of the chi of mizonos. So it's much harder. Rabatzi writes for the father to wheedle out of the chi of mizonos by saying that he's not sure that the child is his, or he knows the child's not his when they're already married to each other. But if they're not married to each other, so that's a different story. Even if it's nisuim ezrachim, so there as well, the Yotzei Poskim quotes nisuim ezrachim. So people think if they're civilly married, they treat it like it's a regular marriage. So it's as if they kind of enter into a hischaivus towards each other, that if a child would be born to the woman, that the husband's taking upon himself that he's going to sustain the child, the assumption would be that the child belongs to the husband, that's the civil law husband. But let's say they're not even civilly married to each other. So then, and they have this paternity fight, and the general sheet is there at the Rivash, and the wife is screams, "What are you talking about, Rivash? But I know that the child is his, and I want the mizonos to be provided." So they used to have a test which was for the blood test, which was the ABO test, that they figured out blood, they tested blood types. So if they knew that the parents that the father was an OO blood type, and the mother was an AB blood type, and then my mother gave birth to an AB blood type, so there's no way that she would give birth to an AB blood type if the father was an OO blood type. There would be some sort of an indication of the father's blood with respect to the child. So they could prove not that they couldn't prove paternity, but they could disprove paternity on the basis of this test. They could disprove that this person was really the father of the child. And so, could you rely upon that type of test? So that was a big machlokus, a very, very big and heated machlokus. And Rav Uziel at Tzitz Eliezer were among those who said, absolutely, you can't rely upon the test. And what's the reason that absolutely you can't rely upon the test? Because the Gemara Nida in Daf Lamed Aleph says that the mother provides the odim, she provides the red part. The wife, the husband provides the white part, the father provides the white part of a child, and the husband and the wife provides the red part of a child. There are two different girsos in the Gemara as to whether that includes dam or it doesn't include dam. The Gemara throws in dam. It includes the dam as well. So assuming it includes dam, or assuming that implicitly includes dam, because dam is red, so how could you possibly rely upon a test that indicates that blood has anything to do with the father? That flies in the face of the Gemara. The Gemara says that blood has nothing to do with the father. That blood only has to do with the mother. The mother's the one who provides all of the blood, so therefore you can't rely upon this test. So there was an article, Dov Frimmer wrote an article in issue 35 of Asya magazine, in which he quoted from Rav Yitzchak Isaac Herzog from the Heichal Yitzchak, who was kind of paying attention to this whole dispute as to whether you could rely upon these tests or whether you couldn't rely upon these tests. And he said that not to rely upon these tests is like sticking our heads in the sand. He said it's like being ostriches. He says that explicitly. He says it's like you're being like an ostrich, you're sticking your head in the sand. He said you can't deny science, that science has a conclusive way of determining paternity, and you have to reinterpret the Gemara. So it's like Rosh Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said, Yitachein, Shedivei Chazal Einem Kol Kach Kepshutam, that the words of Chazal weren't intended to be 100% literal. Lo Nogea Klal, Sugei Adam. They don't have to do with the blood types. But he felt you couldn't rely upon it anyway because he felt that the blood tests were not 100% reliable. I think they had something like a 90 to 93% reliability at that point in time. But it was only a robe. And as I said, they couldn't definitively establish paternity. So there were different camps as to whether you could rely upon this type of test or whether you couldn't rely upon this type of test. But there was a Maisa Listor. The Maisa Listor is from the Sefer Chassidim. The Sefer Chassidim talks about the case of Rabbi Sadia Gaon. The Rabbi Sadia Gaon had a case in which there was a man who went with his pregnant wife to Medina Sayyam and with his slave. And then they came back and the slave said, "I'm the son." And got all of the man was dead. And this slave, I don't know, he dressed himself up as maybe he was a young slave. He said it was many years later. He said, "I'm really the son, and I should inherit everything." And then the real son came along and said, "This slave took away my entire Yerusha. that he claimed to be me, claimed to be the son, and I'm really the son, and he's the slave. And nobody knew who is the prince and who is the pauper, who is the slave and who is the real son. So so Avsajigon did a test in which he took a bone from the dead father, and he took the blood of the son and the blood of the Eved, and the blood of the Eved did not get absorbed within the bone, and the blood of the son did get absorbed within the bones. He said, so this is really the child, because it was his blood matched the other blood, and they got absorbed. So we see that we are able to conduct some sort of a blood test. So so it seems that the Gemara isn't necessarily meant to be understood kipshuto, or it could be that the way in which blood has an effect on the bones is something that even according to the Gemara can be countenanced. That's why there was a later test that was utilized. It's called Bedika Rikmis. I think that sometimes you look at some of these tshuvos and it's unclear like which type test they're talking about. When they talk about a dikarik mist, they talk about DNA, they talk about, so for a period of time they weren't talking about DNA. They were talking about a separate type of test, which is called HLA. HLA is also a test that isn't done that much anymore. It's the human leukocyte antigen system, that they would test they would compare the genetic fingerprints on the white blood cells. So some said, okay, this is blood. But number one, it's white blood. It's not the red blood. The Gemara was only speaking about the red blood, not talking about the white blood. And number two, this isn't only an examination. Rav Duchovsky writes like this. It's not just an examination of the blood. It's an examination of all the tissues and all the cells, the entire structure of the cell system throughout the entire body. And that's something which certainly could come from both the father and the mother. So that's something. So they used to do these testing through the HLA. And HLA had apparently 99.6% accuracy, something very high like that. So Avdukhovsky said maybe that's something that really technically we could rely upon if it has such a high degree of accuracy. So there were, he has a very interesting tshuva with a married couple in which there was a question whether to rely upon that to prove that the father wasn't really the father. At the end, after he says that you definitely can rely upon it, he says, but except in this case you can't because of some technicality, because it was a very strange test that would have turned out that the child received 100% of everything from the mother, which doesn't make any sense. It's like the tests show that not only was this father not in the picture, but it was an immaculate conception. There's no other father in the picture. Everything came from the mother. So since it's already strange to begin with, so we have to consider other strange possibilities that maybe in this particular case the father really was involved, was the father despite the test. So, but he does countenance the idea. This is something that could be relied upon. So then Rabatsi says, what about DNA? Nowadays I have DNA. So he says, well, when it comes to DNA, so now I have a serious consideration, because DNA testing is not 90%. It's not 99%. It's not 99.6%. He says DNA is the chance of error for, this came up with the World Trade Center Aguna cases, an identification that was made based on DNA. The margin of error for DNA is like 1 in 1 billion or 1 in 1 trillion. I remember they would give us the odds. So based on every single identification that they made, there was one case where it was the margin of error was less than 1 in 1 quintillion when it came to the DNA testing. So he said this is something.
You're not factoring in blood.
Not factoring in lab error. That's correct. I think that what's interesting is that when they were giving the 99.6%, accuracy in sort of in the HLA test, for example, they were factoring in lab error and the like. But when the DNA, somehow it doesn't get down to 99.6. Somehow they're more confident that they're not going to have the lab error. I don't know. But with all of that, so he writes that Karo be'enai l'chaivo, that he says that. It appears in my eyes that one really could rely upon that. But he said, I'm not going to completely rely upon my das. It will depend upon what others have to say on this subject, because it has all kinds of repercussions and implications. So a lot of... In the Dina Ishus of Ezra Batsri, in the chapter... In the chapter on... Piskei Din unpublished. But a lot of the some of the Dayanim in Eretz Yisrael are strongly in favor of not utilizing these tests where it could potentially present a mamzeris shali. Even though some of them have written, well, it's not going to present a mamzeris, because mamzeris, even if I have 1 quintillion of a possibility, so that already creates a suffix of some sort, that we're not going to declare mamzeris so fast. And there's always the argument, if you assume that artificial insemination doesn't create mamzerus, so maybe it was done through artificial insemination, as Rabbi Williger said. So it's possible that maybe you can let the offer the father from his mizonis obligation without declaring mamzerus, but not according to Rabbi Yosef Rabbi Yoshi, because they say it's haba atalia. So therefore, it's very hard to get off the hook in a marital situation, but in a married situation, it seems that if you're looking to prove or disprove, determine the paternity of a bahal apnuya, so not only but it would seem that even if you're able to prove through a very reliable paternity test something, you know, that has the reliability of DNA, that's something that really should be able to trigger a yechiv mizonos if it's something that really has, you know, absolute reliability, and I don't have to worry about other repercussions, or I don't have to worry about mamzerus issues where halachically it could be that I'm not going to declare the child the mamzer in a marital situation, in which case, according to Rav Avadya Yosef, that would trigger the chi of mizonos. However, if it's a non-marital situation and I'm only dealing with a mizonos obligation, so then it would seem that one should be able to rely upon this type of test for purposes of a mizonos obligation. You don't have the concern that you're going against Chazal by relying on a blood test, because DNA is certainly not a blood test. It's DNA, you're looking at a certain cell coding that is true of the cell formation, which is throughout the body. So I'll just conclude by quoting the comment of the Rashash. The Rashash asked the question of the Eliyahu Rabbah in his commentary to Baba Basra and Daf Nun Ches. The Gemara in Baba Basra and Daf Nun Ches tells the story about Rabbi Bona. Rabbi Bona had somebody who came to him that there was a man whose wife said, oh, you know, of all the children that I had together with this man, only one of them belongs to him. So when he found out about it, he said, okay, I'm going to give my entire Yerusha to the one child who's really mine. But they couldn't figure out which is the child that's really mine. So they went to Rabbi Bona, and Rabbi Bona said, oh, well, you know, you should all knock on his kever and have him, you know, indicate which one is really yours. So they all went to the kever, except for one of them who didn't feel like it was the right thing to do. He said, ah, the one who didn't go to the kever, that's the right child. So the Rabbi says, why didn't he just do like Rabbi Sadyagon's blood test? He could have taken a bone from this fellow and mixed together all of their blood and would have seen which blood got absorbed within the bone. So the reason that he didn't want to do that is because he didn't want to prove Mamzeris this way. He was able to say, if you have a Svara, that he wanted the Yerusha to go to the one son who was the most Sanua. Maybe it was really his son, maybe it wasn't really his son. However, if I would have done anything else, and that would have proved Mamzeris, so then I would have created a Mamzeris problem, and that's something which we're supposed to avoid. So therefore, we have to be very careful and very circumspect when it comes to utilizing these paternity tests and other devices, that we're not supposed to proactively do anything which is going to create a possible Mamzeris dispersion. And therefore, these tests should only really be utilized in ways in which they're going to be helpful, even in terms of determining a chiyuv mizonos, in terms of resolving an aguna situation, and things of that variety. But we always have to calibrate our methodologies very, very carefully in order not to create more problems than the ones that we solve.
March 3rd. Who's second?